You're tuned to 1520 WCHE Radio, and it's time now for the Avid Reader Show with your host, Sam Hankin. Sam will offer reviews and interviews of some of the more interesting books and authors of today, and now Sam Hankin.
Afternoon, everyone. Welcome to another edition of the Avid Reader, brought to you by Wellington Square Bookshop, my bookshop, best bookshop in the world. Today, we are lucky to have with us Corinna Wolf, author of The Insomniacs, published by Putnam, which is a division of the Penguin Young Readers Group. And it's illustrated beautifully by the Hiltz brothers. This is their first foray into children's books. Corinna studied literature and film in New York, Paris, and Dublin, and now works in the television and film production industries. She lives in Manhattan. Well, you know, so after 3 years and way too late, I'm finally, you know, after I've interviewed like 150 people, I'm finally interviewing someone who's written a book for children. And it's way too late because when you think about it, you know, how teachers have the most important job in the world. Well, children's authors have a really important job, too, because they're the ones who kickstart imagination, curiosity, and a love of reading, you know, for exploring, for acquiring information. And isn't, you know, the acquisition of information, learning as much as we can about the universe and why we're here, the most important thing we can do while we are here? Well, as usual, enough about me. The Insomniacs is a story about a family, a loving family, whose mom is relocated to a job which is 12 time zones away, and it's about how their acclimation to that temporal displacement is accommodated, or not, by that same family. So, Corinna, welcome to the Avid Reader, and thanks for joining us today.
Oh, thanks. Good to be here.
So, what brings you to insomnia?
Well, I would say I am genetically predisposed towards insomnia. And since I have long sleepless nights, I was thinking about it and I realized like, oh, my older brothers all have this problem and my much older parents have this problem. So basically I had already slept as much as I was ever going to sleep for the rest of my life. And I thought there has to be an upside to this. So that's sort of part of what generated this picture book story, is like trying to think of the good part of something that could maybe be perceived as negative.
Well, it's fun. Well, yeah, and the Hiltz brothers say they're insomniacs too on the back jacket too, and
yeah.
So am I.
I think it might be a modern condition actually.
I think it's a sign of intelligence.
I hope so.
And I mean, you know, look, you're a very busy woman. You have all these things that you're doing. What would prompt you, one, to write a book, and two, the very difficult job of becoming a children's picture book, board book author? Why that way?
You know, I didn't plan it out, actually. I mean, it's sort of serendipitous, let's say. Not an accident, but serendipity. The first things that I wrote, I sort of always knew I wanted to write things, but I wasn't sure about the form. And the first things I wrote, you know, when I was in high school were poems. And so actually, the idea for The Insomniac sort of came to me like a poem. So it was like I heard the first line and then the rest of it followed, sort of like pulling the string on a trap door, you know? So I wasn't even thinking ahead to what it could be, although I knew, you know, I knew it wasn't like a poem for grown-up readers, you know, but after the fact, after I had written the first draft, I thought, well, it seems there's something almost like a fairy tale about it. Maybe this is something that could be a work for children. So that was kind of that was the beginning of it. And then I was friends with Ben Hiltz, actually mostly through the internet because he has like a beautiful blog of images that he's an art director in his professional life. So it was just sort of like a curated page of interesting images, and we'd become friends. And that's how we sort of started swapping work. So we, you know, we were kind of friendly before we knew we were actually going to collaborate on something.
Yeah, and you know, it's funny. I'll ask some questions later on, but yeah, it does kind of read like a poem. There are a lot of like metaphors and word plays in there that seem very poetic, and I didn't really think about it in those terms. But yeah. And I don't, you know, I don't want to get like into symbolism or Jungian archetypes or anything like that. But your story does have, as a fable by Aesop would, a moral of sorts. And one of the reviews, for example, said that you know, it was one of those reviews that is like a warning for children. What's positive, negative? Like as if, I mean, warning for parents, as if parents don't know. But one of them says, it says that the positive point of the book includes the idea of teaching the concept of not being afraid of the dark and that it's fine to live differently than everyone else. And then also,
I think, you know, it's funny. It's like, I think the second thing is probably, it wasn't in my mind. Like, I'm not sort of a person that where the first thing I want to think about is a message that I want to come across. But I think, you know, a theme can kind of help shape a work, and that definitely that's something that I hope is taken away from the book, you know, that it's sort of about accepting difference of all kinds, you know, and rather than letting yourself be a victim of some kind of difference, it's like finding it as a strength.
Well, it's funny because the review also, I guess it's recommended, I think it's recommended for children of 3 and up or something like that. And
yeah.
I like it because, you know, the first concept of not being afraid of the dark, well, you think that wouldn't mean anything, but for a 3-year-old kid, that's kind of a cool way, if he does have some kind of trepidation, he or she, it's kind of a cool way to make it seem like, you know, it's a happy time. It can be a happy time.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, the kind of flip side, I think the fear of the dark is sort of the fear of the unknown, and kind of nighttime and darkness are sort of spaces where your imagination can kind of overpower anything else. And, you know, so that can be a space for scary things, but actually it can, you know, it's a place where a lot of just wonderful things happen. You know, there are all these amazing animals that live at, you know, that really live at night, and kind of landscapes and spaces that are really interesting at night. So it's really to think about the positive things about nighttime and darkness as much as it was to think about this particular family going on a journey and sort of changing a bit about who they are.
You know, it also talked about the family, and they were in the reviews, it says how, you know, the family, the mom is kind of a role model because she's an astronomer, the dad's kind of a role model because he's a photographer, and it gets kind of, you know, reductive, but it is very true. And then Mika is, you know, a very curious, pleasant, adventurous girl. So you do have, you know, actually a lot of positive things. And I, you know, in reviewing books with authors who have written novels and nonfiction, I realize it really is a different job writing for kids. And it's not that you're writing down, it's that you have to, you have to approach them in a different way. And I think you did it very successfully in this book.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, I mean, I think it's, I think writing for kids is different in a few ways, like, you know, because it's, especially because it's an illustrated work, so there has to be room or a balance between what the visual element does and what the text does, you know, and hopefully, you know, one doesn't make the other redundant, you know, so that's one thing to balance that I think other works don't have, but I think the great freedom of it is that, you know, there's no expectation of realism, like, you know, you're sort of free to imagine whatever you want, and if it's presented in an appealing way, you know, kids will go with it. So that's kind of exciting.
Well, how did it work with the hilts? I mean, did the cover come first? Did the illustrations come first? Did you work together, or did you give them the copy and then they illustrated it? How did that process work?
Yeah, well, basically, I had seen some paintings that Ben did, and he's like a wonderful painter, and his works were sort of on the border between figurative and abstract art. And he actually had done a series of paintings which he had called insomnia paintings, which was kind of a funny coincidence. So I had seen that work and I thought it was so beautiful, and he asked to see some things I had written. I had just written a couple of stories that I realized were for children, so I just sort of sent them to him. Then he came back to me and he was like, oh, my brother and I actually work together as an illustration and design team, and we're interested in illustrating this story, you know, and so I was kind of excited by it, the idea, but I hadn't actually seen any work that would reflect, you know, what this book would be by him. So I was excited but a little bit cautious. And then a couple weeks later, they sent me a few sketches, one of the father character and one of this enormous sort of intriguing house that they envisioned the Insomniacs living in, and they were just incredibly beautiful. So I, you know, any hesitation that I felt was sort of swept away by how great these illustrations were. And then I showed them to, you know, just friends, and they wanted to print them out and hang them up. You know, it was like people were so attached to just these sketches that seemed like a really good sign that, you know, these artists were doing something that was incredibly appealing, like, immediately. So after they did that, then they sort of got to work. I mean, basically, when you are putting together a book that you're going to submit to a publisher and it's illustrated, you put together a dummy book. So you do some sketches and you give like a sort of sketchbook of what you believe the book will look like, along with, you know, it's really unusual to submit a book in the way that we did, where we're coming in as a team, but you know, as a practice, an illustrator, an author illustrator submit this kind of dummy book with a manuscript and with images together.
Yeah, and owning the bookstore that I do, and I don't work with the kids section that much, but just watching the kids and how they play with books and stuff like that, this book is really made well, and also it even says in the back that it has, you know, reinforced binding, and it seems kind of silly, but it really makes a difference. And I'm holding the book in my hand now, and so it's like, it's much more sturdy than a lot of board books are.
It's really nice, because the art director at Penguin is this incredible, you know, sort of famous woman in her field named Cecilia, and she kind of worked with the artists. I mean, and, you know, they can speak for themselves about that process, but, you know, Putnam and Penguin gave us sort of a great vote of confidence, because the artist really wanted a particular kind of paper and look for the book, which, you know, of a higher quality than you might normally get as a first-time author or illustrator. And so we were allowed to have that. And, you know, so the book is an object, you know, which is, it's sort of a piece of art as much as it is like a bedtime book or a thing to read every day. And that's what's really nice about it. It feels like you're holding something kind of special, like, hopefully that's like biased, but true.
Oh, it is. No, because it's funny, when books like this come in, we automatically put them on a display stand rather than putting them on the table. And this, and, you know, we did that with this automatically. And you can do that because it's not going to fold or bend or something like that. It'll stand up to being on that display without slipping off or bending and stuff like that. So, yeah, definitely makes a difference, and the quality is clear in it. So what's your favorite book?
What's my favorite book for kids?
Well, what was your favorite book as a kid, and what's your regular favorite book?
The picture book that probably influenced me the most is probably the picture book that influenced everyone the most, which is Where the Wild Things Are. And, you know, I'm just so attached to everything about the book, you know, how fantastic, you know, this kind of journey is, and also how elemental the feelings of the kid are in the story, you know. And, you know, it was really interesting on Maurice Sendak, I think his 80th birthday, there was this big reading in New York. All these famous actors came and sort of interpreted. Did you go to that?
No, but I read about it.
Yeah, it was so beautiful. And so it was this really interesting event. And I always thought it was a funny thing because Wild Things, like, if you translate it, like, Maurice Sendak told this story at this event that Wild Things is a, like, in Yiddish, is a thing like that you would call bad children or wild children. And that was something that I had sort of been aware of from my own family. So it was funny to kind of recognize that connection, like, you know, calling someone a wild thing or a wild animal was this thing for naughty children as much as for the monsters in the book. So that was something that, you know, just always appealed to me. And then, you know, it was sort of like my gateway drug to reading all kinds of other things. And, you know, I guess C.S. Lewis was sort of the next step after that, and, you know, and beyond, you know, and I still read children's books and YA and middle grade books today, not just because I'm a writer, but, you know, just as a reader. you know, and I would say as a grown-up, my taste has kind of changed quite a bit. And so, you know, some of my favorite things are more like Mavis Gallant, like her collected works, and some stuff by Graham Greene. And I lived in Ireland for a long time, so I'm attached to Dubliners and Ulysses. So I've gotten a bit away from my origins, but I realized, you know, for pleasure and for emotional attachment, I think, you know, things written for children are really so fundamental for everyone. You know, even people that stop reading or become consumers of other kinds of media, those early things are really vital.
And it's funny you said gateway, because it was like the same for me, and I went on to read, you know, the Narnia books, and then further along, and then somehow that did lead me to James Joyce. I don't know why, but it did. And one of the reviewers also, your book, was talking about essentially what you were saying. This is a gateway. And it even said for future readers of Neil Gaiman. And Neil Gaiman, of course, he wrote American Gods and Ocean at the End of the Lane and Neverwhere. But he also wrote Coraline and this new one, Fortunately the Milk, which is also really funny, too. So, and I was talking to the staff at the bookstore about what do you think that means. And it was the idea that, you know, I don't mean it like this, but a regular kid might go on doing a certain thing, but if someone is interested in your book, they've got a little quirk to them, and so they're going to end up reading writers who are quirky, which I think is great, because it gives them this, what you were talking about earlier, is this idea of freedom, you know, that things don't have to be, you know, it's like, you know, make sure you color inside the, you know, the margins, that kind of thing.
I feel like one of, you know, he's such a like wonderful lyrical writer, and I feel like he really has kind of has his own sort of slightly gothic approach to, you know, modernizing a lot of older stories along with, you know, generating his own stories, which is really exciting. And I feel like, you know, grown-ups love his work because it's like everybody's looking for plausible magic, you know, like that it's like something that's sort of intriguing, but that doesn't feel wholly fantasy. And I feel like he sort of bridges that really well, like some kind of realism that kind of moves into complete magic and fantasy, which I think is fantastic. So, you know, he's so exciting to kind of see what he does.
Yeah, and then you can go beyond, you know, and whenever I talk to authors and if their book is like slightly that way, and I mentioned the term magical realism, they either get really mad at me or they say, yeah, that's what it is, but they don't like that title. A lot of them don't like magical realism. But then you think of Gabriel Garcia Marquez, who just died, and his body of work, and that's like one step up, you know. So when you talk about a gateway, there's so many places you can go. You can go to Borges. There's so many authors, or Hermann Hesse, and what I think is so cool is that this kind of book, and I was going to go through some of the, well, like for the metaphors, like when you use in there, like the dough rises like the sun, which is one of the terms or phrases you use there. I always wonder, how does a child, well, maybe not a three-year-old child, but a five or a seven or an eight-year-old child, or someone who, you know, like we've talked about, you know, reading Harry Potter or something, does a child conceptualize the, you know, the idea of dough rising like the sun, the two uses of the word rising? Is this?
Yeah.
Yeah. Does it?
Yeah. I think the best thing about kids' books is that if they're successful, like if they do their work on the kid, and the child becomes attached to the book, they want to hear it more than one time, you know. So it's sort of a tricky thing thinking about how elevated the language can be or how complex it can be. But the upside is that if they feel attached to the words and or the images, they'll want to go back to it and sort of decipher it. I mean, I know a lot of children that I've read the book to, the first thing I have to do is talk about what an insomniac is,
right?
Because, you know, the title is a pun, it's the name of the characters, but it's also a, you know, this quality or affliction that they're dealing with. And so the kind of key concept is something that a lot of kids have to learn about. You know, they understand about sleeping or not wanting to sleep or not being able to sleep, but then they have to learn that there's a term for that. But they seem sort of excited about, you know, the learning, which I think is another part of kids' literature that's sort of woven into kids' literature, hopefully not in an overbearing way, you know, is the educational part of it.
Well, you know, it's funny, and I'm going to read these, and, you know, these are things you wrote, but I'm going to read them. So,
okay.
Like, and that's where, when you think about Doe Rising Like the Sun, that's where the poetic aspect that I hadn't really thought about comes into place. I was just thinking, what a cool metaphor for a child. And the other thing is, you got to remember, parents are reading these, so parents should be interested too. And so you have to, like, make it so, yeah, it's you know, it's something that they can see as well. So, like when you say, Dad takes pictures and takes 40 winks, you know, again, that's that double take kind of thing. And you pull down the shades and pull up the covers, which is a great image. And then the mom, who's an astronomer, looks at her star sign and her and a horoscope. Or it's the idea of something being tiresome by being awake all night long. Yeah, it's tiresome. Or photos in a dark room, or night school, or moon bathing, or nightshade vegetables, or the fact that they wear midnight blue clothes. All those things are really, I think, really, really cool. That's it.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, no, well, I think, you know, obviously it was sort of written in a somewhat thematic way. You know, it's like a word story as much as just a story about plot, you know. So it was fun to kind of think about all the things connected with the word night and dark. And, you know, the flip side is that I feel like it's, a lot of parents have said that it's fun to read if they know they're going to have to read a book over and over again. It's fun to have one where, you know, there's some unusual language or there's some humor or interesting concept to think about again and again.
Well, then, I was going to talk about the animals now, but, and it's funny because the first one, the lynx, you know, because you say he takes cat naps. And, you know, maybe the first time or the second time or the 10th time the kid doesn't get that. But then all of a sudden he goes, oh, it's a cat, and he takes cat naps. But, you know, but I can take a cat nap too.
And, right.
And so you have the lynx, you have reindeer, you have bears except there aren't any, you have mice except there aren't any. Then you had the bats, and one reviewer was silly and said the kids would be scared, especially when the bats fly off.
That's funny. Yeah, no, I think there seems to be, I mean, it's just interesting to interact with the book with kids, and you know, it seems like there's something suspenseful and thrilling about it, but not too scary.
Yes,
you know?
It so. Isn't, but it's dark, and that's really hard for illustrators too, because you know, you're dealing with a book that's about nighttime, so it's really hard to do really good illustrations that don't allow you to bring in the sun, so to speak.
Yeah, well, I feel like, you know, Ben and Sean, that's one of their specialties, like that's
yeah.
You know, working with these really beautiful blues and, you know, darker colors. And, I don't want to speak for them, but I think it was like a whole educational process, kind of understanding what printers can do, you know, like large scale printers can do on, you know, when you're working with such darkness. I think that was something that they had to work out, but they worked it out sort of beautifully, you know?
Yeah, and especially the cover, which is, you know.
Yeah.
Like, you know, I said that, you know, you can't judge a book by its cover, but everyone who comes in my store does, and especially kids' books. I mean, they see this cover, and obviously it looks inviting to not only the adults, but the children as well.
Yeah, and they're brilliant. Like, they sort of designed the typeface, and, you know, the book has been published in a few other languages, and so, you know, when it's gone to these printers in other countries, they've had to go in and sort of redesign letters in other languages so that, you know, so it'll be consistent with this cover. So
It's nice with kids' books because, you know, the translation is very important, but the images work universally, which says something about something, but I don't know what it is.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I mean, hopefully it means that it's sort of widely appealing. I mean, what was fun for us about this book is that it's been published in a couple of Scandinavian languages, and in my mind and in the Hiltz's minds, we always imagined that it would be someplace like Scandinavia, that where the characters move to. So it's kind of fun and interesting for us that people in those countries wanted to sell the book there in their own languages.
Yeah, it is a perfect Scandinavian. And I think Mika in Finnish means who is God.
Oh, I didn't know that. Well, you know, the funny thing is Mika in Scandinavia is a boy's name, and in Japan is a girl's name. And so for me, the inspiration for the character was someone I knew when I was in college who lived in New York, and she was basically a nocturnal person. And her name was Mika, and I figured that she had just never gotten over the time difference between Japan and New York. And so she, you know, it's a little homage to her that the character is called Mika.
And the weird
as a girl.
The weird thing too is, like, since we're talking about Maurice Sendak and Wild Things, is Mika also, for some weird reason, Mika also means who is God in Hebrew. They mean the same thing in Finnish and Hebrew. So you're like, you pick. It's like I was thinking,
yeah,
she picked it.
I'm asking important questions. Yeah. Very, very secretly.
Well, back to the animals. So you got the walrus, you have aardvarks, you have an angel shark, which is interesting, you have a bandicoot. And then you have a Zorro. No one knows what a Zorro is, so I had to look it up. And it's the Spanish word for fox, which I should have known because of the TV show Zorro, the movies.
Right.
But apparently it's really a dog. It's not a fox. I didn't know that.
Huh. Well, so, in my research, it was listed as a kind of fox.
Yeah, the word means fox, but then I went to Wikipedia, so anyway.
Huh.
So Hispanic foxes, do you know why their ears are so big?
Please tell me.
No, you know why they are.
Well, I know that they're desert foxes. They're North African foxes. And so I was reminded that the reason why their ears are so big is because they perspire through their ears. It's like their air conditioning system. So
it's kind of cool that you know that, right?
Hmm?
It's kind of cool that you know that.
Yes. I know. Well, they're sort of fascinating to look at. They're of all the foxes, they're an intriguing subsection of foxes.
But they're all the animals are like kind of pleasing looking animals, you know? Except for the night beetles, but I don't even really know what night beetles are.
Me neither, but they exist.
It's funny, I have weird things about animals. Like when I was younger, I used to think that their noses were on their faces, but I can't explain what I meant. It was like their snout was their nose, so they didn't really have a face. It was like their nose was on their face. Well,
right.
That's meaningless. But anyway, the other thing I thought was that until I was like 35 years old, I thought that goats were female sheep.
That's funny.
Don't they look like... I mean, no, sorry, I thought goats were male sheep. So don't goats look like they should be the males? And
well, they do seem like they're related. I will give you that. But I mean, I can understand like the conflation of the goat family and the sheep family.
I just missed a day of school, but I missed like most of school anyway, so it didn't make any difference. Well, anyway, so like, you know, this is half an hour on a children's book, and it really deserved it because, you know, it has a lot in there, and you know, it's obviously popular at our store, and I assume it's been popular, especially since it's been translated into these other languages. I'm sure it's gotten popular everywhere. Do you have plans for sequels or a series?
I would like that. You know, we're all sort of going off in our own directions, but I would love to return to the Insomniacs because they're, you know, I definitely didn't conceive of them as a single adventure. So hopefully, you know, the things that I have in the pipeline next are actually completely different stories. And I know that Ben and Sean wanted to try their hand at writing story as well, but as well as illustrating. But I, you know, there has been interest in sort of, you know, creating other works about these characters. So we'll see what happens.
Cool. Well, like you said, it happened because of serendipity, so maybe, probably, it'll happen again because of serendipity. That's always
good.
Yeah,
I hope so.
Okay, well, thank you, Karina, very much for joining us today, and hopefully when the next book comes out, we can talk again.
Oh, great. Okay. Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Okay.
Bye.
Bye.
That was Karina Wolf discussing her kids' book, The Insomniacs, which was published, I guess it's published like a year ago, something like that, but
I would highly recommend it. It's got, you can't miss it when you come into the store. It's got a really cool cover, and it's a very nice book, and it's nice, like we were talking about, it's nice for an adult to be able to read a book at night to a kid, where the adult gets as much enjoyment out of it as the child does on several different levels, which happens here. So, next week, the best-selling author of The Disappearing Spoon, who I interviewed for The Disappearing Spoon about 2 years ago, which I just remembered, is Sam Keen. He's going to be here discussing his latest work, which is The Tale of the Dueling Neurosurgeons. He always has cool books, in which he explains the brain's secret passageways, but while he does it, he's like recounting stories of common people whose struggles, resiliency, and humanity, I guess, made modern neuroscience possible. So it's about the idea of science, as the word Karina was using, conflating with itself, and how dueling hypotheses end up in a kind of synthesis of ideas that bring us where we are today, much the way Newtonian physics was transported by Einstein. And then Einstein led us, even though he wasn't too happy about it, into quantum physics. And now here we are, where just a couple of days ago, this 117th element was produced in a super collider, you know, creating a, what am I talking about this for? Forget it. So anyway, next week, the Disappearing Spoon author, Sam Keen, will be here to talk to us about The Tale of the Dueling Neurosurgeons. Thanks, as always, for joining us on The Avid Reader, and come back and join us next week.
You've been listening to The Avid Reader Show with your host, Sam Hankin. Sam will be back next week with reviews and interviews of some of the more interesting books and authors of today.